proceed to the second case of the day. Dr. Buell versus Emergency Medical Associates.
Please accord. My name is Terry Bueller. I am here on behalf of Dr. Gear, the relator. Dr. Gear filed this False Claims Act case accusing the defendants of defrauding Medicare by double billing him while he was working as an emergency room resident, finishing up his board certification requirements for emergency medicine. Specifically, Dr. Gear has alleged that the defendants billed him to Medicare for as both the attending physician and as the resident for a single shift, double billing. The lower court entered summary judgment based upon the public disclosure bar that's applicable for False Claims Act cases. The lower court concluded that the scheme that Gear had alleged in the complaint had already been the subject of a great deal of public discussion. It had been the subject of a GAO report. And the court also concluded that the identity of the defendants had been publicly disclosed. Based on those two findings, the court entered summary judgment, dismissed the case. Those findings, I believe, were in error. The publicly disclosed scheme in the articles cited by the defendants, relied upon by the lower court, is simply not the same scheme that Dr. Gear has alleged in his complaint. If I could take you back to December 1995, Health and Human Services issued new guidelines at that point, effective July 96, and the guidelines were for when it's appropriate for a teaching physician to receive reimbursement for medical services provided to patients. And those new guidelines, clarification, I believe Health and Human Services called them, required that the doctor be physically present when the services are performed, if they wanted to be reimbursed for those services. And this, the physical presence requirement sparked an enormous controversy in the medical industry. It also caused the government to launch what you'll see in the papers referred to as the PATH audits, the Physicians at Teaching Hospitals audits. And it is these PATH audits and the physical presence requirement that Medicare required in order for doctors to receive reimbursement as teaching physicians that is the subject of the articles and the GAO report relied on by the lower court, referred to by the defendant. And if I could just take a moment to point out to the court, I have in my hand the defendant's statement of uncontested material facts. The judge in the court below relied specifically on exhibits G through B or something like that. Anyway, exhibit G is an excerpt from the GAO report. And at page 6 of the Exhibit G, I quote, PATH audits focus on two major areas of concern. The first concern is whether teaching physicians who billed Part B for services furnished by residents provided sufficient personal direction, that is, physical presence, in the delivery of a service. The OIG considers that the requirement for sufficient personal direction is met if the physician was physically present while the service was delivered. That subject rings through all of these media reports. For example, Exhibit H, physicians must either personally furnish a service or be present when it is furnished by an intern or a resident. Exhibit I refers to, and I'm sorry, H and I are both industry letters. Exhibit I says, quote, "At issue in the audits is whether the teaching physicians were physically present when they provided supervision of residents for which they subsequently bade the teaching physicians billed Medicare." Goes on. All of these articles are concerned with whether a teaching physician has to be physically present in order to then later bill Medicare for service. This is not the same as double billing a third-year resident for a single shift as both the resident and the attending physician. I would suggest to the court that the schemes are different, that the public disclosure bar should not apply to the lawsuit. Dr. Gere set out the allegations of his complaint based on his personal knowledge working in the hospitals. The documents that have been attached include rosters of schedules for when the residents work as both residents and attending physicians. This comes from his personal knowledge. There is no similar fraud I'm aware of that has been alleged or described anywhere else in the country. If you disagree with me on that, then you need to decide whether the defendant also has been sufficiently identified in the public record so that the disclosure bar operates for that reason also. The defendant must, the defendant must be sufficiently described so they can be specifically identified from the public record. I don't think there's any question that the defendants have never, names have never been in print associated with Medicare fraud, certainly of this sort. The only
thing that would be the particular defendant, or can it be citywide or statewide or industry-wide practice?
Industry-wide, I would say no, Your Honor. Citywide is a tougher question. There are three cases that the defendant cited and relied upon. One case refers to identifying a discrete group of, I think, nine potential defendants. That was sufficient. The other case identifies a discrete group of 22 potential defendants. That was sufficient for those courts, not this court, but for those courts to conclude that the defendants had been publicly disclosed. I would take issue with those, Your Honor. I don't think it's enough if you've got one company committing fraud out of 22. I don't think that's adequate disclosure. I think this court's decision in Feingold is about as far as I think I would go, certainly, in a public disclosure of an entity short of actually naming the entity. And in Feingold, some of the underlying documents identified it the entity by a billing code, and if you were enterprising enough, you could get into government documents and trace the billing code back to the entity. But here we have 1,200 teaching hospitals across the country. Simply saying this is happening in a teaching hospital, I don't think is adequate public disclosure.
Mr. Brewer, let me ask you this question. With regard to the past audits, if someone were aware of the fraud that is evidenced by the past audits, is it your position that would not alert them, inform you to the fraud that Dr. Gere is charging?
I think that's right, Your Honor. The past audit would not have picked this up. So far as I understand,
I wouldn't pick it up, but if you were an inspector in this area and it had been brought to light the fraud that is evidenced by the PATH audits, would that lead you to the kind of, to reflect upon the possibility of the fraud that Dr. Gere?
Possibly, but I think it would also cause you to reflect on just the generic nature of fraud in an industry. And then I think I would ask the court to go back to the statute that says, you know, public disclosure must be disclosure of allegations and transactions leading to the fraud. My understanding of it is if you have to have public disclosure of critical elements, I ought to be able to take a public record and frame out a complaint from that. I do not believe that you can take the public record in this case and frame out the complaint that Dr. Gere made. Dr. Gere operated from his personal knowledge. There was no public precedent for it. So based on my view that there was no public disclosure of this fraud and no public disclosure of the defendant, no way to determine who the defendants were, I'd ask the court to reverse the lower court's decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bureau.
I did not address the additional appeal on the bill of costs. I think everything I need to say has been said in the briefs.
Uh-huh. Is that large A?
It's late A, Your Honor.
Oh, late A. Well, they've got an R here. They've got an R. Is that the spelling?
No, Your Honor. Instead of an R, it's an I.
Okay. Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court, Dave Leger for defendants at Appellees. Your Honor, I want to address two of the questions the bench posed to Mr. Bueller. First, Judge Evans, you asked whether the disclosure need to name a particular name or whether or not it's sufficient that disclosures make potential defendants identifiable. It's settled well both in this circuit in the Feingold matter and in several other circuits that the key is whether the disclosures of either transactions or allegations of fraud are sufficient to put the government on notice that certain entities are perhaps committing fraud. In cases that we cited, the Fine case and the FPC Boron case, that's exactly what happened. Industry-wide allegations were sufficient to alert the government to fraud, and that in turn was sufficient for those disclosures to apply to industry participants who were not specifically named. What is particularly compelling about this case is, however, not that these defendants, not that the Midwestern residency program was identifiable, but the government had gone several further steps down the line. The government had initiated an audit, an investigation, a nationwide protocol that necessarily was going to get to every teaching program in the nation. So it's not a matter of hypothetical identifiability. The government, based on information that it learned years before Dr. Gere filed his action, had initiated this nationwide investigation. And that is of great importance in applying the public disclosure bar. This court, in the Feingold decision, said, it suffices to reiterate that the function of a public disclosure is to bring to the attention of the relevant authority that there has been a false claim against the government. Where a public disclosure has occurred, that authority is already in a position to vindicate society's interest. And the key TAM serves no action, no purpose. Here, the government was not only in a position to do it, but it was well along the way.
If a Chicago newspaper published an article that some investigative reporters had determined that there's double billing going on at three or four hospitals in Chicago. Would a claim done by a lawsuit, one of these false claims lawsuits by a doctor in Louisville, the hospital he works at, be barred?
Your Honor, it depends on the specificity of, you say it's double billing scheme. If it's the same exact double billing scheme that is in the Louisville hospital, yes, then that public disclosure would be sufficient.
So
to simply that somebody's defrauding Medicare is not enough, clearly. And this leads to the second question I wanted to address, which Judge Fong, you raised, which is, well, would a PATH audit, is it the same scheme or not? Would a PATH audit have uncovered this? The distinction that Mr. Bueller attempts to draw, with all due respect to him, is illusory. The issue is whether Medicare is being billed for services provided by unsupervised residents, both under as a fee-for-service as well as part of a grant issued to the hospital for teaching these residents. So the question is whether there's double billing for unsupervised residents. The very same OIG report that Mr. Bueller mentioned from specifically, and I cited it in my brief, specifically says that the long-standing concern is the danger that Medicare will pay twice for the same services, once as a fee-for-service, once under what are known as GME block grants. This is precisely the scheme that is alleged here. What is alleged are residents Burbank residents acting as residents are nevertheless being billed as attending physicians. And the double billing comes in because there's a fee-for-service bill as well as a block plan. It's exactly and precisely the scheme. And I won't go through all the various disclosures that...
Are you suggesting it's the same because it's under the label double billing, so it doesn't matter whether it's a nurse or a physician?
Not at all, Your Honor. These are very specific services. These are services provided by physicians on the floor of the hospital, typically the daily rounding that we're familiar with. It's a very specific service, and the issue is, if I want to know whether Medicare should be billed for that rounding on that particular day, I check to see whether the doctor on call on the service was a resident or not. If the doctor on call is a resident, then I have to check. If I'm a government auditor, I look and see, well, was there an attending who was also there and present? And what Ms. Bonner has alleged is he has an unsupervised resident and provided this very specific service, and he got billed from Medicare under Part B. Well, that's exactly what the PATH audit was all about, and that's exactly what the PATH audit was intended to uncover. And it would have, if it existed, would have uncovered. The government did investigate these allegations, and as the court knows, did not intervene in the case. I'd like to explore some of the voluminous disclosures. We didn't put all of them in the record that we could have, but they're, I thought, enough to demonstrate that this was the hottest in human academic medicine through the mid to late 90s. I want to talk for a moment about the Seventh Circuit and definition of derived from. When is KTAM action derived from a public disclosure? The Seventh Circuit has held that a matter is derived from a public disclosure when it essentially its essentials are based on it and is actually derived from. Okay, in two cases, this has come up in two cases.
It's derived from what it's derived from? Is that what you said?
Yes, Your Honor. It sounds like a self-definition. Quoting directly, Your Honor, and I apologize for being
misunderstood
from Matthews, if the public disclosure information, is actually derived, is essential to the claim, then the claim is based upon that public disclosure. In Matthews and in Feingold, and here, you have a relator who says, but wait a minute, I know some things which are not public. I attach to my complaint some schedules, a contract or two, fairly, you know, innocuous things on the surface. What's attached to the complaint does not support the cause of action. In Matthews, it had to do with a loan that Ms. Matthews had guaranteed for her son, and the loan, the bank did not report the fact that her guarantee to a federal agency had also guaranteed the loan. She knew a lot. She had a lot of individual, non-public information about that claim, but the critical piece, the central piece of that claim, was that the bank did not report to the Guarantee Association. That's a fact she learned through public disclosure, through in that case.
So what's our comparable critical fact that was disclosed in our case?
In this case, while Dr. Beer knew what this schedule was and knew what the other doctor's schedule was, the only reason he knew that Medicare, that this issue of double billing, that this issue of billing for unsupervised resident services, coupled with the fact that Medicare doesn't pay for those unsupervised services, that came to him through these voluminous public disclosures. He's derived the essence of this claim, which is there's a problem with billing it this way, from numerous public disclosures. And that's why under the definition from derived from as developing through Matthews and Feingold fits fully in this case, and why Judge Norgo correctly held that this matter was derived from these public disclosures. The other problem, which is Judge Norgo also pointed out quite well, is the only evidence adduced on the whole derived from issue from Dr. Beer was a wholly self-serving affidavit that basically said, I didn't know anything about PATH, or I don't remember knowing anything about PATH, and I didn't derive any of this information from public sources. Now, the first problem with the self-serving affidavit, as Judge Noble properly pointed out, was that's not enough to get a person over a summary judgment hump. And a self-serving affidavit simply doesn't get you past summary judgment. Secondly, as Judge Noble pointed out, the fact that Dr. Geer alleged that he didn't recall knowing anything about PATH in that time frame was, I think Judge Noble said it's strange credibility, because as it turns out, Dr. Geer was a resident editor of a national publication for emergency department residents, which in the summer of 1999, when he was an editor, published a story about the PATH audits. I think by that point, the government had collected some $70 million through various cases stemming from them. And that was one of, I think, six or seven articles in that publication. So, in it, put very plainly, Dr. Geer had a burden of proof to show that his matter is not subject to the public disclosure bar, and he failed to meet that burden, and that's why Judge Norgo correctly concluded that the public disclosure bar barred the case. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
A couple of observations about the PATH audit. I don't want to take a lot of the time and repeat myself, but I would like to point out to the court the PATH initiative initially was intended to audit 10% of the teaching hospitals in the United States. It was later scaled back. That was too ambitious. So relying on the PATH initiative to ferret out Medicare fraud in 1,200 institutions, I think, is kind of an optimistic view of the PATH initiative. More important, the PATH initiative was not aimed at double billing. I cannot stress strongly enough to this court, the PATH initiative was designed to pick up situations where a doctor, a teaching physician, attempted to bill Medicare without being physically present with the patient assisting in the examination.
But is that a difference that really significant?
I mean, absolutely.
It isn't a classic double billing. It's sort of a phantom billing, right?
Phantom billing. So I guess.
Because one thought is a double billing, one is a phantom billing.
Well, that is the mechanisms, Judge.
On the one hand, you have one doctor being charged to Medicare twice. On the other hand, you have the resident certainly being paid his salary under Part A, I believe. But you also have a doctor who may or may not be in the hospital who then seeks reimbursement for Medicare. They seem to me to be two completely different schemes. And certainly the point's the same, which is to overbill Medicare, but I don't think that makes them equivalent. I don't even think it makes them terribly similar.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks to all counsel. And the case is taken under advisement. The court